You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Caden Tokawingawa. No mai, haere mai, ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rāpare Thursday. My name is Caden and I'm your host for today. I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in the studio for the last time by producer Jasmine. E wha ake nei coming up on the show, for our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party, I spoke to MP Shannon Halbert about Labour leader Chris Hipkin's State of the Nation speech and the government's move-on orders for people who are homeless. And I spoke to Matt Raskovic, International Business Professor at AUT, about Aotearoa New Zealand's ranking in the Global Corruption Perception Index and the number of high performers who are backsliding. Jasmine, what have you got for us today?
For City Counselling this week, I spoke to Councillor Shane Henderson about move-on orders, the possibility of a measles outbreak and the Chinese Lantern Festival. I also spoke to Oliver Christella, Senior Human Rights Advisor at Te Kahui Tika Tangata, the Human Rights Commission, as well as Rachel McIntosh, Secretary General at the Etu Workers Union, about the 2025 amendments to the Equal Pay Act and how they undermine human rights to pay equity. I also spoke to Hilton Freund, Global CEO of the Twinning Project, about the debut of the football rehabilitation program for near-release prisoners in Aotearoa.
Hea ha o whakaro. I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395 or wae mai rāne. Give us a call in studio on 3093879. Ka wea wari wari I ana koutou, te whakarongo ki ene kōrero ano. He pakehere roki roki mārunga I te pai, tukutuku o Erangi Pōho, mihari ki 95BFM, erekati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Text in your thoughts on Nima Toru Iwa Rima 5395 or give us a call in studio on Toru Kore Iwa Toru Waru Fitu Iwa 309-3879. Now let's get into the show.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with Labour MP Shannon Halbert.
On Monday, Labour leader Chris Hipkins gave his State of the Nation speech at the Auckland Business Chamber. The speech has been criticised by the opposition for its lack of policy announcements, with National's Nicola Willis describing the speech as being as substantial as jelly. Instead, the speech focused on bigger picture ideas of who the Labour Party is in 2026 and what they hope to achieve, broadly speaking. And the government has announced it will give the police new powers to issue 24-hour move-on orders in town centres across the country. Aaron Hendry, youth worker at Kickback, expressed concern about the impact of the orders on young people and called for the government to bin the ban. For our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party, I spoke to Shannon Halbert about all of these topics. I started by asking, what did Chris Hipkins mean when he said the public will see a different Labour to last election?
Chris Hipkins outlined his vision for Aotearoa New Zealand. We've got a very strong focus on jobs, health, homes and real action on the cost of living. These are the things that people are telling me and my community and around orientation weeks at universities that they want us to focus on. And so I'm really pleased that that's what Chippy outlined in his State of the Nation speech.
Hipkins said affordability would be at the heart of all of Labour's decisions. Could you elaborate on this?
It's a common issue for most people. In Auckland alone, I hear about the increase of public transport fees, the unaffordability of renting and living in the city. The cost of food is significant. People are finding it tough, and this government under Christopher Luxon promised to fix the cost of living. They haven't done that, and so they're really pushing Labour to be able to provide some respite, really. And that's been our commitment for this election, and that's what we'll be focusing on.
How will Labour's focus on affordability differ from this government's promise to bring down costs through running a tight budget?
Well, this government has committed to landlords and tobacco companies. We'll be focused on working people, making sure that our most vulnerable are supported, and ensuring that that taxpayers' money is well spent. Most of all, we hear New Zealanders. We understand and empathise with where they're at, and you know, we feel aroha for them that they've felt let down by a national government that hasn't cared and has under-delivered on their promises.
Hipkins also spoke to the number of young New Zealanders leaving the country. Why is this an important issue for Labor?
Well, that's a significant one. And at the university orientation starting this week, young people have been telling me directly, not only is it more expensive to live as a student, it's more expensive to study as a student. Alongside that, they find it more difficult to find a part-time job and work while they're studying to support their living, and that they're very concerned about graduate opportunities because they seem to be few and far between. That is a result of Christopher Luxon's economic management. He hasn't been able to improve the situation for New Zealanders. People don't feel the green shoots that he often talks about. And so as a result, they're looking offshore to be able to fund a lifestyle that they want to live and get by.
And I want to now turn to ask about the Move On orders. What is your response to the government's new orders for people who are homeless?
This is a continuation of this government's attack on our most vulnerable in New Zealand. It's not a solution. It doesn't provide any housing respite for our most vulnerable out on the streets. It doesn't respond to evidence that tells us how we actually deal with homeless people, how we resolve it, and put support mechanisms in place. It simply moves people from one spot to another and doesn't resolve the issue at hand.
How concerned are you about the young people who could be impacted, given the orders can apply to people as young as 14?
It is terrible that we would impose a $2,000 fine on a 14-year-old or put them in prison as a result of their homelessness situation. We have to be frank that under Christopher Luxon and his government, homelessness numbers have increased, that they cut housing, investment in housing, and as a result, people have less housing options available to them. So this isn't just an ongoing attack on our most vulnerable, and sadly it's our rangatahi who are impacted by this.
The National Party says their motivation is the number of tourists and others feeling unsafe in our CBDs. What alternative solutions would Labor propose?
Well, Labor stands for investing in actually resolving the problem at hand. Under Labor, we continued to build social and public houses. We put emergency housing in place as a temporary mechanism for those who found themselves displaced. We invested in support systems, not just in housing, but to ensure that people had the access to mental health and addiction services. And so that's what you can expect from a future Labor government. We will actually invest in the problem at hand.
That was Labor's Shannon Halbert on Labor leader Chris Hipkins' State of the Nation speech and the government's Move On orders for people who are homeless.
That was our weekly chat with Labor MP Shannon Halbert.
Now, tell me about your father.
City Counselling on 95BFM, our weekly chat with the good people of Auckland Council.
As just discussed, central government has granted new police powers to issue move-on orders for rough sleepers around the motu, with failure to comply resulting in penalties of a $2,000 fine or the possibility of 3 months incarceration. Two cases of measles have been reported in Tāmaki, both of which have been linked to overseas travel, and the celebrations continue this week with the Chinese Lantern Festival taking place this weekend at the Manukau Bowl. I spoke to Councillor Shane Henderson about these topics. This week, central government have issued police the power to deliver move-on orders for rough sleepers. How do you feel about this decision?
Yeah, personally, I think it's really disappointing. It doesn't address the core problems and the systemic problems that are driving people to homelessness. Because the fact remains, look, where are we moving them to? And if homelessness is essentially a crime in the city, punishable by a fine, well, by definition, they cannot pay fines. So, you know, the next step is prison, and that's not the sort of society that I think many of us want to live in. So, yeah, look, personally, I was extremely disappointed with the news. The other thing I just add is, look, a lot of the services are located in the central city that actually give homeless the dignity and everything that they need to live on the street. So they've got a bit of a difficult choice of, do I need to access the social services required? Well, in a lot of cases, they're in the city and maybe they're not allowed to be here. That's a frustrating situation and kind of a bargain for them that I think is totally unfair, and it's not what should be done in a democratic society, frankly.
What is the dynamic of communication between central government, Auckland Council and police on addressing support?
Yeah, like in terms of that dialogue, from the council side, we continue. First and foremost, we've actually got to see the detail of what's being proposed. So until that sort of occurs in a more sort of clear fashion, we can't really respond too much other than to say, look, we're continuing to do the work that we have committed to do. We work closely with housing providers and with social services, and we want to continue that work as best we can. So, yeah, nothing will change at our end until it changes.
And there have been two measles cases confirmed in Tāmaki this week. What is the scale of public concern this stage regarding an outbreak?
Yeah, at this stage, there's no cause for widespread concern. And just pointing out that we had an outbreak recently that we have quashed already. So we're match fit on this. But what I would say, this is where a bit of a detailed bit comes in. But there's locations of interest that have been released. So if you're on flight SQ281, this is how detailed we are, from Singapore on 17th of Feb. If you're at the airport on 17th of Feb from 11:30 p.m. to 1:30 a.m. or Waitakere Hospital 21st of Feb 9 till 11, then call our health line, which is 0800 611 116. That's 0800 611 116. And things can get sort of sorted out from there. But yeah, now we've got experience in this. There's no issue at this stage in terms of widespread concern. But just keep an eye out, and if you are sick, stay at home.
And the Chinese Lantern Festival is coming up this weekend for those ideally that are not sick and staying at home. Do you have anything to share about this event or anything else you're excited for in Tāmaki that's coming up?
Yeah, it's awesome. Lantern Festival is going to be absolutely fantastic, and hope to see everyone there. Auckland's got a great sort of little awesome summer of events still to come, and we've got movies and parks until 21st of March. Do check that out online and see where your local locations are. Universities are reopening, and the new fresh batch of students there, that's pretty cool. That always brings life into the city. And also Pacifica Festival, middle of March, 14th and 15th at Western Springs. I'll see you there as well. So all happening in Auckland as always.
That was Councillor Shane Henderson on Move On Orders, the possibility of a measles outbreak and the Chinese Lantern Festival.
Have you tried mindfulness? Try mindfulness.
City Counselling on 95BFM.
Why do you think less students are choosing to study at university?
Well, because being a student isn't sexy anymore.
The Wire.
We'll be right back after a short break. Keep it on the beat and text in your thoughts 5395.
Get out your speediest eyewear. The B-Rave is back, and faster than ever before. B-Rave, Friday, March 6th at the Mothership.
Stepping up to the booth for your entertainment is a host of iconic 95BFM DJs, including Co-Governance,
Rosetta from Breakfast, Nicholas from Drive,
Stinky Jim, Naru back-to-back babyface killer, Porcelain back-to-back pros.
Race you there. 95BFM, Spades, Kira Huketsu and Under the Radar present B-Rave at the Mothership. Friday, March 6th. Tickets available now at Under the Radar.
Everyone, I have invented a magical hat. It offers to wear a protection against bricks, anvils, pianos, sidewalks and more. Go on, throw something at me. Ow! Throw at my head! My head! Not at my...
Helmut are heading to New Zealand, and we have tickets for our favourite kind of people, B-card holders. So stay tuned to 95BFM Drive for your cue to enter. 95BFM presents Helmut at the Power Station Sunday, April 12th. Tickets available now from helmutmusic.com.
Jazz Cigarette, Bob Hope, Dubage, Jar Rastafari, Wacky Backy, Mez, Mary Jane, Marley, Sheba Cheba.
Whatever you call it,
Muggles.
Marijuana Media has you covered. Every Thursday on 95BFM Drive, join Chris Fowley from Normal for the good word on law reform, cannabis in the media, and the latest in green science. Marijuana Media, 420 every Thursday on 95BFM Drive. Thanks to The Hemp Store. Visit them at 253 K Road or shop online at hempstore.co.nz.
Ah! Guys! He finally asked me out! He says he knows a spot.
It better not be ice cream at Mission Bay.
I hope it's not under the Harbour Bridge.
Oh no! What if you have to walk up Mount Eden?
He better not think Minnehaha is original.
Oh, thank God. It's a beer spot. I can try the new local brews.
The 95BFM Drive Show. A 3-hour psychedelic playground of japes, jive and jams. 4 to 7pm every weekday only on 95BFM.
Thanks to the beer spot, your tappy place.
Once a Sunday night, when I saw the red light, far from the pain, I didn't know that the grass is not only greener. I'll keep it super. I lay with the stars, and I didn't know that this girl was not only harder, oh, but colder when you are not around. I love you, my darling, I do, but I can't reposition. So I ran with dreams to reach the skyline, straight up that incline. I ran towards the blue, and I didn't know that this sky is not only wider.
Is his hole, and do
that is not in the public interest, I can assure you.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire. The Corruption Perceptions Index, which is published annually by the civil society organisation Transparency International, recently published their report for 2025. New Zealand had a positive placing, sitting joint fourth with Norway, although has been sliding down the rankings for the past 10 years. There are noticeable slips amongst other high-performing countries, and notably the United Kingdom, Canada, and Sweden, along with New Zealand. I spoke to Matt Raskovic, Professor in International Business at Auckland University of Technology, about the rankings and what it means for Aotearoa New Zealand.
So there's basically two parts to this story. Transparency International, which is a leading global civic organization, every year publishes a Corruption Perception Index, or CPI, that's measured on a scale of 0 to 100, 0 meaning a country is completely corrupt, and 100 meaning a country is completely clean of corruption, right? So it's an inverted index. And based on this score, CPI score, then they publish a global ranking of countries according to perceived levels of corruption, right? So there's a global ranking that rank orders in any given year around 180 to 185 countries around the world. And this ranking is based on the Corruption Perception Index. So according to the latest ranking that was released a couple of weeks ago for 2025, New Zealand maintained fourth place, but its CPI score actually dropped by 2 points from 83 to 81. Now you would think, you know, why is this such a bad thing? Being top four in the world is still pretty good. If we take a step back and actually look at how New Zealand's CPI score has been doing in the last decade, then we see a much different picture. In 2015, for example, our score was 91 out of 100, right? In academic terms, we were an A-plus student, and we were ranked number one in the world in terms of the lowest perceived levels of corruption. Basically, we were the top student of the class, the gold standard for everyone. And over these last 10 years, every year our CPI score has been kind of dropping by a point here, 2 points there, and in the latest one, by 2 points. So we've come down from 91 to 81. Again, in academic terms, we've gone from an A-plus student to an A-minus student. What's even more worrying is that if this trend continues as early as next year, we might drop out of the top performing group altogether and all of a sudden find ourselves in a B-plus group.
Can you speak to why New Zealand's ranking is falling?
Absolutely. So there's a couple of factors here. Overall, what we can observe is that a lot of top performing countries, such as Canada, United Kingdom, Sweden, Switzerland, as well as the United States, have been dropping in their rankings and have also had significant decreases in their CPI scores. So as I've mentioned already, New Zealand's CPI score dropped by 10 points. As a comparison, in the same period from 2015 to today, America's CPI score dropped by 12 points from 76 to 64. So what we're seeing is, in some sense, not completely an isolated event for New Zealand, but the scale of this CPI score declines is much, much more significant. Now, I've mentioned that currently New Zealand is ranked number four, equal to Norway. 2 years ago, we were still among the top three. And while Norway, compared to the previous year, was able to maintain its CPI score, 81 out of 100, New Zealand actually dropped from 83 to 100. I know it sounds very technical. Basically, Norway maintained the same score, but actually improved its ranking, climbing from fifth place to fourth place, while New Zealand's CPI score dropped by 2 points, but we managed to barely maintain fourth place. So there's two parts to this story. One is how the actual CPI score is performing, and the other is then the rankings. And sometimes your CPI score can drop slightly, as in the case of New Zealand, and you still maintain the same ranking. Sometimes, as in the case of Norway, your CPI score remains the same,
But actually, your ranking improves because a lot of other countries have seen a decline in their CPI score. So there's kind of an absolute and a relative aspect to these rankings.
And I want to ask, you've mentioned some of these specific countries like Norway and the United States, but what are some of the overall global trends we are seeing in the index? And how do massive events like the election of Trump or war in Gaza impact the rankings?
So overall, over the last decade, we've seen quite a significant decline in a lot of top performing and middle performing countries. And this is a fairly new trend, right? You would expect from countries that have historically had very high levels of corruption, right? These would be countries in sub-Saharan Africa, for example, that, you know, their corruption landscape would further be deteriorating. But we're really seeing a new trend of, you know, strong countries that have safeguards in place to fight corruption, and that the landscape, the anti-corruption landscape in those countries seems to be deteriorating. And as I have mentioned, countries like Canada, countries like the United Kingdom, Scandinavian countries like Sweden, which 10 years ago were among the top performing countries, have seen drops in both in their rankings and in their CPI scores, as well as New Zealand and the United States that I have already mentioned. So 10 years ago, you would have had 12 countries that would have been in the A range, right? 12 countries whose CPI scores are 80 or above out of 100. Today, there's only 7 of them. So basically, the group of A students, top performing countries when it comes to corruption, anti-corruption activities and fighting corruption, has basically more than half. What's really interesting is also two-thirds of all countries around the world would, in academic terms, be perceived as failing students, meaning that their CPI score is below 50 out of 100. The global average is 42. So on average, your average country around the world is basically a failing student when it comes to fighting corruption and anti-corruption measures. What we have seen this year is, for the first time, the global average CPI score has dropped from 43 to 42. Now you would think, okay, you know, 1% drop, what's the big deal? It's actually quite a big deal because at such a low base, every little change, particularly negative change, is a fairly big deal. And the fact that the global average has changed in the last decade for the first time tells us that there are structural forces and different factors at play at the global level that are really kind of contributing towards a global level decline in terms of how do we fight corruption. And we can say that perceptions of corruption are on the rise everywhere globally in countries that have strong safeguards like New Zealand, as well as in other countries.
And I know this is a very complex issue and is probably quite country dependent, but what are some of the obvious solutions on a national level in Aotearoa, but also on an international level?
That's a really good question. And the headline for that question, the headline answer would be, the writing has been on the wall for over a decade, and the current and previous governments seem to not have been interested in addressing some of the issues that Transparency International New Zealand, academics like myself, have been kind of calling out for. So the good news is that New Zealand has a very strong and a robust anti-corruption baseline. And what that means is that if we put in place certain safeguards, we can fairly easy or relatively easily protect that strong baseline before it really gets eroded. New Zealand is the only country out of the Five Eyes countries, so out of this military strategic alliance with the United States, Canada, United Kingdom, and Australia, that doesn't have a national level central government managed anti-corruption agency. Australia introduced the National Anti-Corruption Commission It passed legislation in 2022, and it actually came into effect in 2023. And that resulted in a 2-point increase in its corruption perception index score, meaning that it improved significantly in terms of rankings. So the first thing is, New Zealand needs to start thinking about having a clear, coherent, national-level anti-corruption strategy. And we should really consider establishing a national-level, central government-led anti-corruption agency. And the writing for these two things has been on the wall for a while, and there's various reasons ranging from complacency to special interests why the current or previous governments have not done much about it. In addition to this, Transparency International New Zealand and researchers that are studying corruption in a New Zealand context have for years been kind of pointing out to a need to strengthen and overhaul our lobbying rules. New Zealand has fairly lax lobbying rules. So how do special interest groups interact with politicians and political decision makers and policy makers? And our system for reporting donations to political parties is also fairly relaxed and intransparent. So in addition to having a clear national strategy and a national level anti-corruption agency, what we have to do is we have to make sure that our lobbying rules are fit for purpose and that there is greater transparency around political donations to specific parties. The recent government in particular has come under increased public scrutiny for having strong ties or strong affiliations with, for example, the tobacco lobby or the real estate lobby. And if you look at who were some of the biggest donors to the current government's the current government, you would see that the real estate sector, for example, is one of the biggest donors, particularly to the national party. So there's a couple of things that need, let's say, overhauling or fixing. And again, the writing has been on the wall for over a decade. There is still time to fix these things. And we do not want to find ourselves in a position where our very strong anti-corruption core and the robustness and integrity of our institutions starts becoming a liability. So there's still time to fix it, but the time is now to really act before we start further slipping down the corruption rank.
That was Matt Raskovic, International Business Professor at AUT, on Aotearoa New Zealand's ranking in the Global Corruption Perception Index and the number of high performers who are backsliding.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
The People's Select Committee reported on the 2025 amendments to the Equal Pay Act in a document published on Tuesday this week, and have revealed that the recent changes to our pay equity laws represent a clear undermining of human rights on multiple accounts. The legislation was passed under urgency last year, making it more difficult to correct pay inequities and freezing the progress of 33 active workers' claims that affect thousands of Kiwis' right to fair remuneration. I spoke to Oliver Christella, Senior Human Rights Officer, Senior Human Rights Advisor at Te Kahui Tika Tangata Human Rights Commission about the legislative changes and how the issue disproportionately affects women-dominated professions. Kia ora, Oliver. What instigated the 2025 amendments to the Equal Pay Act?
Oh, tēnā koe, and thank you for having me on. First of all, I'd like to talk a little bit about pay equity and how it differs from the concept of equal pay. So pay equity is the idea of equal pay for work of equal value, and it's a fundamental human right. It's when workers who perform different jobs, but who share similar levels of skill, responsibility, effort, things like that, are paid the same for the work they do. So it's different from the idea of pay equality, which is the idea that simply we get the same pay for the same sorts of work. Pay equity is recognised by the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and it's protected in a number of international human rights instruments that Aotearoa New Zealand has signed up for. So, for example, the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women and the International Covenant on Economic and Social Rights. In Aotearoa, we do have historic and persistent pay inequities between male and female-dominated occupations. And when everyone is fairly rewarded for the work they do, we're going to strengthen whānau, lift community, and build a fairer and more just society. In terms of the background to the changes to the 2025 amendments to the Equal Pay Act, the 2025 amendments were something that really shocked everyone. They weren't something that had been signalled in the coalition agreements or something that had been signalled to the public in any other way. So it came as a shock to people who were involved in it and to the general public. From a human rights perspective, human rights approach depends on involving people who are affected by a change. And that's not what happened in this case. The bill was passed under urgency, meaning that affected workers, their unions, women's organisations, employers, Māori organisations, experts in the field, and just everyday people didn't have the opportunity to comment on the bill. The rationale for urgency appears to have been to ensure that the bill was put in place for Budget 2025. So we know that the government expects to save about $12.8 billion over 4 years from the changes to pay equity, but these savings are money that would have gone into the pockets of predominantly working women to ensure that they are paid fairly in line with this human right and this principle of equal pay for work of equal value.
How is Te Kahui Tika Tangata holding government to account in their misstep on this issue?
Kia ora. So yeah, I'd like to talk to the role of Te Kahui Tika Tangata. I think I'd first like to pick up on what some of our concerns are from a human rights perspective. So I've already mentioned that the bill was passed under urgency, but on top of passing it under urgency, they cancelled more than 30 active pay equity claims, and this affected well over 100,000 working people. So many organisations, the unions, but also the funded sector, charitable organisations and employers have reported to have been spending millions of dollars and thousands of hours of time, much of this volunteer time, from people to actually put these claims together to demonstrate and work cooperatively to work towards a pay equity settlement. So all of that work now has been set aside. Now people can come and run new claims, but these new claims exist under quite different rules. And for some groups, so for example, secondary teachers, their claims are no longer qualify under the new rules because the definition of what counts as a female-dominated workforce has changed under the legislation. Another major concern is the restrictions on using comparators. So effectively, you can no longer compare yourselves with a group of workers outside of your sector. And this sort of really strikes at some of the heart of the changes of the Act because in many sectors themselves are female dominated. And therefore, if you can't go and find a comparator out of your sector, so say, for example, teaching has historically been a female dominated profession, they might then go and compare themselves with something like, a police force that has been historically male dominated. But now they're not entitled to step outside of their sector and make those comparisons. So for some female-dominated workforces, that will mean that in practice it's extremely difficult or potentially in a practical sense impossible for them to pursue a meaningful pay equity claim. The other thing I'd like to touch on is to speak to Te Tiriti o Waitangi, which is our own unique statement of human rights in Aotearoa. And so Te Tiriti does not only just protect Māori from discrimination, but it also requires that the Crown actively promote equity for Māori. And since the amendments, many of the organisations who work at the coalface have raised serious concerns that these 2025 changes disproportionately affect wahine Māori and see this as a breach of Te Tiriti. So those are some of the core issues that we have. Turning now, sorry, to your question, what is the role of Te Kahui Tika Tangata, the Human Rights Commission, going forward? We are Aotearoa New Zealand's national human rights institution, and our role is to promote and protect human rights here in Aotearoa. And into this, in response to what has been happening, we've taken several steps. Firstly, we've met with a number of the relevant ministers and we've discussed our views on human rights, some of our concerns with the 2025 amendments, and we want to engage with ongoing dialogue. Secondly, we've been quite active in the People's Select Committee. We made written and oral submissions to the Select Committee. And I'd like to acknowledge in tautoko the work that they've done. The committee have produced a really in-depth report on Tuesday, which is now publicly available, and it's an excellent resource for anyone who wants to better understand these issues, and it will be a resource for years to come. Commissioner Pacheco, the EEO Commissioner at Te Kahui Tika Tangata, has written a number of publicly available opinion pieces on pay equity and human rights, and most recently she's produced an article on pay equity and occupational segregation based on some academic study that she's done in these areas. We're also speaking publicly about these issues at Hui, at interviews such as this one, and always wanting to engage with the public about human rights. And Commissioner Pacheco will also be representing Aotearoa at the Commission on the Status of Women in New York, where she'll discuss pay equity settings alongside some Canadian speakers and look at the differences in the pay equity frameworks between Canada and Aotearoa. So one other thing we're looking at going forward is engaging with youth to better understand their views of pay equity and do some youth-focused work in this area.
What international reparations does the undermining of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights have for Aotearoa?
In terms of the repercussions for Aotearoa, the right of equal pay for work of equal value is important to upholding equality and freedom. So a robust and workable pay equity process will result in more equal treatment and more valuing of women. Aotearoa has been long considered a leader in gender equality, and with this backslide on the right to pay equity, people will now question whether to look to Aotearoa as a leader in this space and question our commitment to gender equality.
What are your organisation's expectations from here to progress on this issue?
We intend to continue to talk about the importance of having strong and accessible pay equity settings so that people can meaningfully access the important human right of equal pay for work of equal value.
And then I spoke to Rachel McIntosh, National General at the E Tū Workers Union, about their mahi in fighting for pay equity in the current legislative climate. Kia ora, Rachel. This amendment to pay equity law last year was a rushed passage of legislation. How quickly can it be adjusted or repealed?
Yeah, one of the abuses that has been recognised by the People's Select Committee is the rushed way that it was done. And to be fair and just, legislation needs to be considered, and there's supposed to be a process, which is a Select Committee process. That didn't happen, and that was the abuse. But the People's Select Committee has actually given the legislation that process. And so now that that has happened, it could be repealed very quickly, as soon as the government is prepared to repeal it. They've got the evidence. These discussions have happened. And so it could be repealed under urgency when a new government comes in at the end of the year.
And could you share more about what groups of workers this affects the most?
Sure. So pretty much every kind of work that is mostly done by women, when people have raised claims, it has been found to be undervalued because it's considered women's work, and women's work just doesn't have its skills and responsibility recognised. And so that's social workers, librarians, teachers, nurses. But the group of workers that actually, of all of the female-dominated work, that is the lowest paid is care and support work, and that is something that is really just considered to be something that anybody could do, not very important, and paid often at or very slightly above the minimum wage. And this is work that really gives people dignity in their lives. This is work that is intimate, needs to be done with great sensitivity, is actually skilled and responsible because it's about people's health, and it takes a huge amount of emotional effort as well as quite a lot of physical effort. The fact that the value of it is in allowing people to live a life of dignity. So if you get to a stage of your life where you can't any longer dress yourself, something that most of us would take for granted, to have somebody to do that for you so that you can be in society, that's massive, and it's just been not considered valuable, and that is one of the key areas where this work is undervalued. And so the people doing the work don't get paid enough to live on properly, so they can't live lives of dignity while their job is to give other people lives of dignity. That is one of the greatest injustices in this whole situation.
And how do you expect to see this issue addressed in an election year?
Well, we know that the current parties in power, they passed this legislation that makes it pretty much impossible to get those things fixed. We know that they don't resile from that, so it's not those parties that are going to fix it. So what we expect is that the parties in opposition to stand up really clearly and say, we are for this work. We are for the value of this work. And when we get into power, we are going to fix this situation quickly. And then what we would ask the voting public to do is look at those parties and vote for the parties that are going to allow people to live in dignity, to have their work valued and recognised. That's what we would expect in this election year.
And how can we shift toward being progressive in pay equity legislation, not just correctional?
That's a fantastic question, because there's so much correction that we need to do first before we can get progressive. But legislation can actually lead changes in attitude, because the reason we constantly need to correct this is because of the underlying attitude to the work. And so legislation, first of all, does need to correct it. But also this legislation needs to have, and in fact the old legislation did have, the requirement for review periods, which means that there are constant points in time where the value of the work is reviewed again against male-dominated work to ensure that it hasn't slipped behind. And so when that becomes constant, when the work does have its value recognised and its pay improved, then what we know is that it will attract more men to do the work, and attitudes in society will shift. They do shift over time when you legislate for it.
That was Rachel McIntosh, National Secretary at the Etu Workers Union, following Oliver Christella, Senior Human Rights Advisor at Te Kahui Tika Tangata Human Rights Commission, on how the 2025 amendments to the Equal Pay Act undermine human rights to pay equity in Aotearoa.
Well, if you want to save money in health, it's very simple, you know. It's like shoot all the patients and shut all the hospitals.
The Wire.
We'll be right back after a short break. Text in your thoughts, 5395. This is Just Like Honey from the Jesus and Mary Chain.
We'll be right back. around, you know, up to 8 or 10,000.
Shit.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM. This year, the Twinning Project debuted its pilot program in Aotearoa. The global initiative offers incarcerated persons the opportunity to upskill by obtaining football coaching qualifications over the course of 6 weeks. The near end-of-term certification is paired with supportive rehabilitative pathways to involvement in community and sport, including employment opportunities upon release. The first cohort of 16 inmates graduated in Tamaki Makaurau last week, delivered in partnership with local organisations Auckland FC and Kohuora Auckland South Corrections Facility. I spoke to Hilton Freund, Global CEO of the Twinning Project, who was in Aotearoa to visit the first round of graduates last week. I started by asking him to tell us a bit more about the project, which began in the UK in 2018.
The idea being that our professional football teams weren't doing enough as a criminal justice intervention. So we launched the project, the idea being to twin our professional football teams with their local prison to offer upskilling and employability opportunities to those serving custodial sentences. Over the last 8 years, the project's grown significantly, and I was very fortunate today to be able to bring the project to New Zealand and to Auckland, where we've partnered with Auckland FC, and we were able to do this with the help of FIFA and the FIFA Foundation, who provided the fiscal support.
What has been your most memorable lesson and key takeaway from your time leading this initiative?
I think a key takeaway from this initiative is that we mustn't estimate the power of the sporting brands, the elite sporting brands, to have a significant impact when it comes to things like creating safer societies and reducing reoffending. Those serving custodial sentences have often made one mistake and it ended up with them serving a sentence. What society and community really needs to do is identify what turns the lights on them and what turns disengaged individuals into engaged individuals, those that will make productive pro-social contributions back into society when they get released. And what we've realised is that it's not just sport, but it's our elite sporting brands, hence the value of working with the likes of Auckland FC on this project.
And how, if at all, was the program delivery adjusted from the international model to serve Aotearoa's cultural context and the Kiwis taking part?
So that's a very good question. And the beauty about the project is that it's very modular, but in essence, it's a soccer, bulk football coaching qualification. So the content of the program itself is transferable. What the offenders are learning in England is the same as what they're learning in New Zealand. Obviously, when it comes to the identification of the cohort and the recruitment of the learners on the program, we defer to the knowledge of the correctional facility that might house them. But when it comes to the delivery of the project, it's a coaching qualification that will ultimately enable them to step up and be on the first step, on the first rung of the ladder towards football-based education.
The first cohort have just graduated in Aotearoa today. What is next for them after the program and for the future of this initiative in Aotearoa?
Well, fortunately, FIFA have sponsored a year's worth of delivery, which will ultimately be three cohorts. We today saw the culmination of cohort one and the graduation of cohort one. So there are a number of opportunities available to the graduates. The first being that they will serve as peer mentors and mentors to participants on cohorts two and three. But more importantly and very exciting is the fact that Auckland FC have committed to supporting graduates of the Twinning Project upon release. So when these individuals ultimately re-enter society, they can contact the team at Auckland FC, who will provide them with signposting and pathway opportunities that will enable them to make productive decisions with their life as they go forward.
And is there anything else you would like to share with us today around this initiative?
I think the project itself speaks for itself, and the success that it's had on a global scale is truly magnificent. I think we would be remiss in not being grateful to FIFA and the FIFA Foundation, who are a global football body. Most people think they just put on football tournaments, but they don't. FIFA and the FIFA Foundation support a number of charities around the world, and they enable me to take the Twinning Project, to bring the Twinning Project to New Zealand, to Auckland, and to undertake the project to the benefit of New Zealand and Auckland community and society.
That was Hilton Freund, CEO of the Twinning Project, an international football coaching program to support prisoner rehabilitation that debuted in Aotearoa this year, with the first cohort graduating last week.
That was The Wire.
Ko era te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, that mihi ki a koutou katoa I korero mai ki māua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Wire for our party Thursday. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. Labour's Shannon Halbert, Auckland Council's Shane Henderson, Etu's Rachel McIntosh, Te Kahui Tika Tangata's Oliver Christella, and the Twinning Project's Hilton Freud. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1 to 4 with Sophia.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.